is Stephanie Rubel from the Stanford Alumni Association. I'd like to welcome you to our fifth book of our Book Salon season, Prisoner's Dilemma, hosted by Professor Ari Kelman. Professor Kelman is the Jim Joseph Chair in Education and Jewish Studies, and by courtesy, an Associate Professor of Religious Studies. His research expertise lies at the intersection of education and Jewish studies, with an emphasis on the myriad ways in which people cultivate ethnic and religious identities and practices. He is currently working on a collection of essays entitled Learning to be Jewish, which takes a case study approach to questions about how people learn to be Jewish. The book will take an interdisciplinary approach to a variety of sites from Fiddler on the Roof to the Krakow Jewish Festival. Ari, thanks so much for sitting down with me to discuss this book.
Sure, my pleasure.
So the first question I'm going to ask you is, can you talk to us about why you chose this book?
Sure. So I first encountered this book like a decade ago, give or take. The book, I think, came out in about 1988, and I read it sometime in the, like, right around the year 2000, when I was going through some, I found it sort of incidentally, and I was going through some personal upheaval in my life at the time, and I don't remember what it was that attracted me to the book. Looking at the cover again, it was probably the cassette tape. Because I have an ongoing fascination with popular music. The book has very little to do with cassette tapes or popular music, as it turns out. But there was something about the book that spoke to me about the ways in which Powers represents relationships and the complexities of relationships, how people make decisions in those relationships, the extent to which we're individual actors or the extent to which we're trapped by larger social relationships. And there was something about the way that he conveyed that dimension of human life that spoke to me really deeply at the time. So when you asked me, you know, what books I thought would be interesting to read, I went back to this one because I also enjoyed reading it tremendously. It's really, I think it's kind of serious, but it's a really fun and sort of funny read.
Great. Yeah, we always love reading books that have a personal connection to our faculty. So what issues from Prisoner's Dilemma can you single out that our readers might find interesting to discuss?
I think one of the things that makes this book so interesting to me, and hopefully to you, is that it's a huge book, and it kind of deals with all this stuff. Like, Mickey Mouse is in there, and the atomic bomb is in there, and Prisoner's Dilemma is in there, and game theory, and Stockhausen syndrome, and it's all told through this single sort of dysfunctional family of six, which happens to be, it's the same sort of makeup as my own family of origin, but my own family of origin is very different than the one described in the book. But part of one of the themes in the book is about history and kind of how we as individuals living at a given point in time kind of reckon with the weight of history and how much we're trapped by that history, how much we need to honor that history. That old saw about, you know, those who neglect history are bound to repeat it. It isn't really a central theme in the book, but the extent to which the historical conditions into which we're born determine sort of who we are and who we become is definitely a theme in the book. And then and the ways in which that's both like kind of the particular place and time that we're born, but also the big historical, sort of big forces of history, not just little ones. The second is just the impact of fantasy and how one's imagination can have real effect. So this recurrence with Walt Disney throughout the book and Mickey Mouse and the World's Fair of 1939 and the ways that people kind of imagine the future could be, and how the very act of imagining how the future could be has an impact on what the future becomes. And that's a really interesting theme throughout the book in terms of one's ability to determine one's own, again, like with respect to history, one's ability to determine one's own life course, or are you kind of trapped in it? Or, you know, does the imagination become a better vehicle for telling the truth than the truth does or the facts do? And that's kind of Disney's recurring trope in the book. Another theme is just the nature of relationships. I mean, the title of the book is Prisoner's Dilemma. Prisoner's Dilemma is this famous, is sort of the cornerstone of game theory, which is used in a lot of the behavioral sciences to sort of suss out people's rational responses to certain conditions. So game theory, Prisoner's Dilemma is the dilemma where there's two prisoners and they're both told, I forget exactly, I could I should probably know this, but essentially it involves playing the two prisoners off of each other. And if they both tell the truth, then the punishment is lessened. If one finks out the other, or the other finks out the one, then punishment is sort of in the middle. And if they both fink each other out, then punishment is worse. And then what do you do? Because you're sitting in one room and your co-prisoner is sitting in another room, and you're asked to make a decision that's going to benefit you the most in game theory. And so that framing, actually, of the book, calling the book Prisoner's Dilemma, and then not talking about prisoners really at all, but talking about members of a family who are also trying to make the best decisions for themselves without kind of selling their brothers or sisters or parents down the river, is, I think, a really interesting and kind of diabolical way of approaching the kinds of relationships and the kinds of decisions we all make in relationships. But the interesting thing about this book is game theory and Prisoner's Dilemma is often thought of as being kind of like base level human, a way of determining base level human human interest and human action. But setting it in a family where there's all of these complicated relationships brings into the formula the question of like empathy and care and love and all of these things, which in game theory don't necessarily have much of a place. So just the way that it frames the nature of relationships as kind of things that one is tied into and beholden to, at the same time one is also kind of acting in one's own best interest, and how to balance one's best interest with the interest of other people, I think is a really interesting theme that comes out in all of these complicated ways in the book. And then the other theme is that I found in the book, you know, is this theme between surface and depth. The family, the Hobsons, relish in this kind of wordplay and playfulness of speech, and the father, who's kind of the main character of the book in some ways, certainly he drives the action, doesn't have much of an emotionally revealed self in the book. None of the characters really do, aside from outbursts of anger. They talk in what seems to be a very surface level kind of way. There's a lot of wordplay. There's a lot of games and riddles and quizzes and other things that seem like not terribly complex, or it doesn't seem like what one would think is quality conversation that one imagines happens in a family. But I'm interested in the way that surface, that sort of persistent, deep surface, becomes the way in which this family relates to each other, and that surface actually can be a place of great depth and engagement, even though it doesn't seem that way. And it forces the depth to kind of come up in some really interesting and sort of dramatic ways throughout the book. So those four themes, like the weight of history, the power of fantasy, the nature of relationships, and then the dynamics between kind of surface and depth, I think are all places that, if you can get through the book, are interesting ways to navigate it, sort of threads to pull on as you're reading through the book.
What I love about this selection is that it's so different from everything that we've been reading so far. So I'm really looking forward to it.
How so?
Well, it's just we've been reading a lot of, like, lately we've been doing some prose from Ireland. And then before that, we kind of did an anthropological study on religion. And then we did an AI romance novel with Scott Hutchins. So it's very different, and I think we're all looking forward to it. So,
oh, good.
Yeah. Next, let's talk about your favorite part of the book and why you chose that part.
That's a really hard question, because there's so many powers in this book is so, and I think in his other books too, at least the ones that I've read, he's so playful with his language, and there are so many places where there's a throwaway line or an aside that I think capture, and he's also so good at kind of these very pithy references or encapsulations of other themes that are going on in the book. It's one of the things I think he does really, really well. And so there's so many places where there's a line here or a line there that kind of catch my eye or caught my attention as particularly poignant at that moment in the narrative, or particularly evocative of something that had happened, you know, a page ago or a chapter ago. And they send me scrambling back to look for what the connection is between that comment at this moment and what was said before. I love the title. I just think the title is just a brilliant title. But I think my favorite, like, section of the book is chapter 11. Which describes Eddie Jr., who's the youngest son of the family, on a date with a girl whose name is Sarah. And in that, in the chapter, it sort of describes this very funny courtship. And it does that surface and depth thing that I was talking about before, where he's very at ease with it's very flirtatious, the whole conversation, the whole description. And Sarah doesn't appear again in the book. She disappears. She appears in this chapter and then disappears. She's kind of a passing figure in the book. But that chapter, he reveals a bunch of things about the family. Eddie Jr. reveals a bunch of things about the family. And the whole interaction is this beautiful, flirtatious romantic encounter, which is often the way that early romantic encounters go, even though often when you're involved in those kinds of exchanges, you hope that it's going to become something deep and significant, but they start in these very playful ways. And I think that, and that chapter in particular does that work in such a beautiful way, and it demonstrates the kind of playfulness of the romantic encounter while revealing all these other parts about Eddie's life anyway that are actually quite meaningful in the ways in which he has this kind of broad knowledge of like classic movies. They end up talking about classic movies, but when she asks him, oh, have you seen it? He's like, no, I haven't actually seen that movie. I just know about it. So again, it's this beautiful play of kind of surface and depth. He has this very broad, capacious surface knowledge of popular culture, but he hasn't actually seen very much of it. Doesn't have a kind of personal experience of it, but he knows of it. I don't know, which also to me speaks to like the way that we today consume so much of our information. Like you can get a ton of information just by like scrolling through the front pages of websites. Like if you scroll the New York Times and Yahoo and whatever else, and Gawker, right, you could get you would know exactly kind of what's happening in the world in a very surface way, but a very broad way. And the way that that surfaceness gives way to a kind of depth. And at the end of the chapter, she kind of, they have this exchange around his family and his love for his family that I think is really poignant and beautiful. And then you know, he has this sort of visceral emotional reaction that is really different than his kind of very quick-witted and sharp and articulate way of engaging her otherwise. And I just think that that interplay of the surface and depth of the promise of a future romance with the kind of flirtatious lightness of that first kiss or the first the sort of first first engagements with a person just so beautifully and cleverly captures so many of those themes in this very iconic, you know, it's November and the air is cool and they're walking home from a movie. Like it's this very quaint sort of Americana portrait. Mm-hmm. But it nevertheless, all of these issues kind of come burbling to the surface in it, but are kind of kept tamped down. So I just think that chapter, it also happens kind of near the middle of the book, just as the weird way in which Powers tells the story, kind of going back and forth in time, for me anyway, began to click in a kind of rhythm. So then you get this picture of this wonderful flirtatious first date that tells the story in yet another way. So that's probably my favorite scene in the book. But there's a ton of lines in the book that I just think are really kind of well-timed little firecrackers.
Oh, firecrackers. I like that. Perfect. Okay. Well, then I think we're going to move on to my final question. What are you currently reading?
I have an almost 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, so I'm reading a lot of Winnie the Pooh lately. to be honest, I have so honestly, and with 2 small children, as some of you probably know, you just have so little time to read, and I have like almost no time to read between my reading for work, which I love. But will be of almost no interest to anybody who may be listening to this. And my reading for my children, which is a lot of Winnie the Pooh and then a lot of Eric Carle books. He wrote The Very Hungry Caterpillar. We read a lot of that book too. The board books in particular, so my son doesn't eat them. I just said, don't have time to read fiction. So that's another reason why when you asked me to offer a book for the book club, I had to think really hard about a work of fiction you know, that I thought other people would be interested in and that I really loved and that I've read recently. And in my own kind of autobiography of reading fiction, like 10 years is recent. So that's another reason why I picked this book, was it was a book that I had read and really enjoyed and looked forward to rereading and really enjoyed rereading it for the book club. But yeah, it's partially due to my own just like inability to read fiction these days because I just don't have any time to do it.
The Hungry Caterpillar is a great book.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mean anything against that. Or Winnie the Pooh, which upon rereading for the 500th time is It's so clever. It's really quite brilliant, that book. And The Very Hungry Caterpillar is no slouch either. But you guys have probably all read that one.
Well, perfect. Thank you so much for introducing us to Prisoner's Dilemma, and we look forward to talking with you soon.
Sure, my pleasure. Enjoy.